Hi, welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. I am your new host, Cammie, and I've done some hosting before for Feminist Mormon Housewives. I am also doing narrating ordained women on Feminist Mormon Housewives, and now I get the great opportunity to host on Mormon Expression Voices. I have with me today Jetta and Adam Knox, and I'm really excited to interview them because we've had a chance to talk a little bit, but I've saved all the juicy questions for this interview. So I'm excited to get to know them just as the audience should be because they're great people. I'm going to let them briefly introduce themselves, and I'll let Jetta go first. Jetta, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, it's Jetta. I was born in the church and was raised by by goodly parents. And I have a good family. I come from a family with six kids, and I fit kind of in the middle. And what else do I know? Yeah, that's about all there is.
And what do you do right now for career or family or?
Yeah, I stay at home right now with my son.
Okay.
And I am trying to enjoy every minute of it because I know it won't last very long. And
yeah.
I nanny a couple of kids too, so I keep myself busy.
Oh, good. And how old is your son?
He's five.
Five. Okay. All right. And Adam.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Cammie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my name's Adam. I'm a lifelong native of Idaho. I was a member of the church for, I guess, a little over 15 years. I grew up in a pretty small family compared to Jetta's. It was just myself and my sister, some cats and dogs along the way. I work for a corporate registrar, so we maintain internet portfolios for Fortune 500 companies, and I'm an avid comic book reader.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
What's your favorite superhero?
Well, Batman. Might as well not be any others.
I love that. It was like, of course, why wouldn't it be Batman?
Yeah, why wouldn't it be Batman? There's other superheroes?
I personally like Catwoman. She's awesome. I consider her a superhero.
Oh, yeah. She's always torn, and those are the best stories, right?
And I think Angelina Jolie should play her. I think she would do a great job.
That would be good casting.
Wouldn't it? I know, right? I should send that in to her.
Absolutely.
Okay. And on a side note, I just saw Maleficent. You guys, it was a really good movie.
It looked really good. I saw the extended trailer the other day and I was really, really interested.
It is fantastic for adults and children. Yeah. Okay. Back to the interview.
Right.
Okay. I'll probably edit that out. All right. So we're going to start off with, Jetta and Adam have a neat story. They obviously had separate childhoods, but they met in high school, right? You guys are high school sweethearts?
Yeah, we are.
We are, yeah.
Okay. So what we're going to do is just kind of break them up as far as the beginning part of their lives until they meet up in high school and just interview them separately, and then we'll interview them together. Okay. So Jetta, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? You grew up a member of the church, right?
That's correct. On my mother's side, my grandmother apparently was baptized when she was pregnant with my mom. Mm. But she was never super active. But then my mom, you know, was wrangled by some, primary leader in her youth and would go to church actually by herself. And, she didn't have a great childhood. It wasn't a bad one, but it wasn't great. And so she decided that she would go to BYU and get married and have a good little Mormon family because that's what she always wanted. Mm. And then on my dad's side, my dad's parents both come from member families, but they weren't super active until they shortly after they got married and started having kids. And my dad grew up on a farm, so he's a farm boy. Mm. And so I have really great parents. They met at BYU and started having kids like you're supposed to. And, so I'm the number four of six kids and, you know, I'm classic middle child. I'm a peacemaker and a pleaser, and I come from a family where peace is necessary at all costs. So there's not a lot of confrontation. There's not a lot of talking about feelings and that kind of stuff. But I had a good childhood, you know, typical. I did the whole primary thing, and I was baptized when I was 8, like normal. And from a really young age, I always wanted to go on a mission, which was kind of an anomaly for a girl in the 80s. But I did, and I always thought that was really neat. I didn't really understand what it meant, but I wanted to do it. And so I kind of had that on the back of my mind as something I wanted to accomplish. And in Young Women's, I was, you know, I was very naive and very, very sheltered. You know, I did the whole class presidencies and, you know, planned activities and was fully involved in church. And it was just a big part of who I was. And I didn't really question it or really think about it not being a part of my life. It just was what it was.
Did you find a lot of fulfillment in Young Women's?
Yeah, I would say that I did. You know, I never, never had like really best friends at church. But I got along with all the girls and we had a good time. And, you know, I did the whole personal progress thing, and I'm a big goal setter and that kind of stuff. So that, you know, that appealed to me. And, you know, we can talk about what this means later, but I felt like I had a testimony. I felt like these things made me feel good, and they were good things. And so I, you know, I just kind of felt like, yeah, it makes sense.
Right. Right. You had good experiences there. It felt good. And
yeah, definitely. I didn't have anything traumatic in my childhood or anything to complain about.
Was there anything that you focused on in school that was your interests?
Let's see. Well, you know, I kind of plugged along. I mean, it was good at school.
Mm-hmm. I could interject for a moment, my wife is incredibly smart. And Yeah, I think I probably need to. She's downplaying it. She's incredibly smart and really excelled at, you know, all the classes she took. Mm.
Okay.
Can you hear me blush through the microphone?
I heard you blush.
Yeah.
We'll try to edit that.
I took Japanese in high school because my brother had just left for a mission in Japan, and it was kind of a new thing that was being offered at my school, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. So, you know, I took that and became very interested in Asian cultures in general and the language. So, and that's also happens to be where Adam and I met. So,
did you guys go over and pick up your brother in Japan?
No, I'm trying to remember if my dad did or not. I don't think so. Okay. Although I did actually have a chance. I begged my dad for my 16th birthday. It's going to make me sound really spoiled, but I'm not, I swear. I begged him to take me on a business trip with him because he was going to Japan, and he had enough like frequent flyer miles or whatever, and he took me with him. And so that was my first experience, you know, traveling overseas. And
wow.
Got to hang out in Tokyo, and this was after my brother had come back from his mission.
Right.
And that was a really good experience. That was really cool.
Wow. Yeah, that's a huge city. Huge.
Yeah. Full of short people.
Yes.
And I'm very tall, so I towered.
Oh, yeah. I bet you did. But since you were little, you wanted to go on a mission. What appealed to you for that?
Honestly, I don't know. I just remember, like, singing, you know, I hope they call me on a mission. Mm-hmm. And, like, thinking, like, that song's about me. And never being like, oh, that's just for the boys. And, you know, I did grow up in a family where, although my parents lived very strict gender roles, my dad was never limiting towards his daughters. You know, he was just as interested in teaching his daughters how to plumb a sink as he was his sons. And so there was definitely an equality in terms of the kids and what we learned and what was expected of us. And I think that really laid a base for me to feel, you know, like I could be whatever I wanted. I could do whatever I wanted.
Wow. That's cool. I thought the same thing with that song. I think I had a little bit of a Viking spirit. I wanted to go on an adventure and.
Yeah, I like that. A Viking spirit. I like that.
Okay. All right. So that brings you up to high school, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so Adam, tell us your childhood, your family, church life.
Yeah, I was originally christened into the Presbyterian Church, which was the tradition of my parents. The name Knox obviously goes quite a ways back with the Presbyterians, so it was something that was important to my family. But I've always called us, we were seasonal Presbyterians. We would go, on the major holidays, but it was never a family tradition. We didn't attend church very regularly. My father was, both my parents, I should say, they're both hippies to this day. And even though they both had to, cut their hair and join corporate life, but they definitely still embody the free spirit that they grew up with. So that was definitely a part of my growing up. I was always encouraged to think for myself and, challenge dogma and things like that. And I really cherish that because it's led me a lot of really good places, I think. But we were a small family, just myself, my sister and I, and then my parents actually ended up divorcing when I was about 10 or 11. And that was hard. They did their darndest though to still be a family. My dad ended up moving to a tiny apartment just around the corner from where we lived. That was hard for him, but it was close to us. And I mean, honestly, I don't remember a day after my parents divorced that I didn't see my dad. He, would come over to the house after work and he would, still do some chores around the house to help my mom out. And it was always, kind of the attitude of making the best out of a bad situation.
Wow. That's good dedication.
It really was impressive. And I as I have grown up and had some adult relationships of my own, I understand that adult relationships are complicated. And I was always, I always felt very fortunate that even though my parents were divorced, they still, pitched in to raise my sister and I. Mm-hmm. I never felt like either of them had checked out and decided to move on with their own life. So it was always, always special.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was. They're cool people. And then so when I ended up joining the church, I think it's probably a direct output of the fact that my parents did get divorced. It was obviously kind of shook my foundations. As a kid, I remember when my mom and dad told me, I remember thinking that all of a sudden I was, just like a lot of my friends. I was going to be, a child of divorce. So when the missionaries came and told me that, families could be together forever, that was a message that spoke really, really quite loud and really quite clear to me.
Right.
Spoke to a lot of my fears, which was nice and comforting. But I went to local schools around here. As Jetta mentioned, I ended up taking the Japanese class as well. I took it because I didn't want to learn Spanish, which was kind of the only other option in our high school, I think.
You guys didn't have French?
We had a French class, and the French teacher was kind of snooty.
Oh.
Who wants to take French?
Yeah, I know. And then I think we had a Latin class, but I didn't see a lot of application in that. So Japanese was kind of the next choice, and boy, did it pay off.
Oh, yeah.
because that's where Jetta and I met, and I remember my tongue was pierced at the time, and I remember...
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Like I said, my parents were hippies.
Awesome.
And I had a lot of leads. So.
Wow.
I remember trying to impress Jetta and her friend with the pierced tongue, and Jetta wanted absolutely nothing to do with it.
Good for her.
It's kind of true.
Oh, that's funny.
But Jed and I met and became fast friends. I've always had a knack of making her laugh, so it was something that I enjoyed being around her.
So you're kind of like the bad boy.
Oh, yeah, I totally was.
Yeah. That's awesome. And Jetta, you know what? This is random, but I've been meaning to ask you this. Is Jetta short for something?
No, it's my full name.
Awesome.
You got to tell the story of how you got it. It's the best.
Okay. All right, tell us.
I don't know if you want to edit this out later, but in college, my parents actually happened to have a friend named Jetta. Well, my dad had a friend named Jetta. And the story
and friend,
is...
she means girlfriend.
Well, yeah, the story is she had a crush on my dad. And when my parents started dating, she told my dad it was never going to work out. And it just wasn't meant to be. And so now, you know, many years later and four children, and they decided to name me after her. And my mom always claims that it was just because she liked the name, but I think there might be just a little bit of, you know, kind of a spiteful revenge kind of thing there. So
that's funny.
I love that story.
That's funny. Oh, wow. Okay. I was just curious. I've been meaning to ask you that. So, okay. So you were kind of this bad boy with the tongue pierce, and you were already a member of the church?
No, I had gotten my tongue pierced and everything before I joined the church. But when I, the bad boy thing is tongue in cheek. I don't think I have that in me.
Got it.
But when the missionaries and you know, Jetta was already, of course, a member of the church. And I remember our Japanese class was right after her seminary class, her religious release time is what they call it. So she would always, you know, she would always come into our Japanese class from outside because the seminary building was off school property. We talked about that and she started to invite me to mutual activities and, I've always been intrigued by spirituality, the esoteric, the occult, things like that. So when she started to talk to me about her spiritual beliefs, I thought it was really interesting. I didn't necessarily have any desire to affiliate myself with the church, but I still thought it was really interesting.
Right.
She eventually did give me a Book of Mormon. I think it was Man's Search for Happiness.
I remember that. The video? Yep.
No, I thought there was a book that Elder Packer wrote.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It had kind of fuzzy pink clouds on the front.
Okay. I remember the video, but yeah, there was a book.
Yeah. And I remember reading that, and a lot of what I read resonated with me. I thought it was a really, it seemed like a system of beliefs that encouraged people and inspired to do better, to make more out of oneself. And that really spoke to me. I really thought that was intriguing. And after, going to church a few times with Jetta, like I said, attending some mutual activities and taking the missionary discussions, I decided I wanted to be baptized.
Oh. And how old were you at the time you got baptized?
I was 15, almost 16.
So it wasn't because you had a crush on Jetta?
No. Okay. It really wasn't. I'd be lying if I said that I didn't see the convenience in being a member of Jetta's church. Right. But it wasn't. Yeah. No, I joined the church because it answered a lot of questions and brought me comfort.
Right.
Yep. Nobody believes him though, especially my father.
Cause he used to be a boy. He knows how they work.
Yeah. What's that supposed to mean?
Hey, I'm just repeating what I hear. So,
sure.
So how did your parents being, you know, the hippie laid back kind of people, what was their response to their son wanting to get baptized?
My mom was, she was supportive. I think she was just happy that I had found God, found Jesus. She didn't necessarily want to join me, but she wasn't, against it in any way.
Okay.
My, my dad was kind of another story. He'd had a lot of bad experiences with members of the church in his youth.
Of this church? Of the LDS church?
Yeah, of the LDS church. Okay. I think he kind of had a, I don't know, kind of a glass half empty view of what the church stood for and the virtues it extolled.
Mm, okay.
So he was very against it. He just like Jetta said, you know, her dad thought I was doing it for the wrong reasons. And I think my dad probably did too, having been a young man himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't very excited. And I think he felt that I hadn't done, the proper, I guess, research.
Mm.
That a decision like I was making needed. Mm-hmm. But I remember he asked me, one day, you know, because I was under 18, I had to get permission from my parents to join the church. And I didn't feel right just getting my mom's permission.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I needed to get my dad's permission too. And I remember he asked me, you know, point blank one day, are you getting baptized because of Jetta? And I said, no. And then he said, well, I trust you, and signed the permission slip.
Wow.
Yeah, it was talk about a leap of faith. Wow. You know, he trusted me enough that, I was making a, you know, an adult decision with a sound mind, and he let me do it.
Oh. Well, that's nice that you had support from your parents. And
yeah. Yeah. And you know, that made things easier as, you know, as I tried to navigate a relationship with them, you know, with the things that the church teaches about people who aren't members, people who refuse, you know, missionary discussion, baptism and things like that, knowing that even though they didn't necessarily support, the church itself, they supported me. That was always a good feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really good. And so, what was your focus in school? Did you have one?
My focus in school was mainly music and video games.
Video games. Was there a class in that?
Sadly, no, that was mostly extracurricular.
And what kind of music?
I was always a big fan of punk rock. You know, the Bay Area boys from where you are,
okay.
Bad Religion, Pennywise, NoFX. I loved punk rock. It kind of spoke to me on a level that assuaged a lot of the anger that I felt from, you know, from just general teenage angst.
Right. What year did you both graduate in high school?
I graduated in 99.
Oh, okay.
And then I graduated in 2000.
Oh, you guys are so young. I graduated from college then. and I was 30, so it wasn't like I was young either. That's awesome. I was wondering, because when I was growing up, there was no tongue pierce, and that was not even heard of. So I was just curious what the year was. So you guys started dating in high school. Tell us what happened with your relationship through high school.
We did start dating. It was kind of a scandal, of course, because you're not supposed to be exclusive with anyone,
mm-hmm.
At such a young age.
Right.
You know, it's funny. No one ever mentioned that to me. And I had, I guess, kind of more of a traditional view of what dating would be. So in my mind, Jed and I were going steady.
Mm.
I realized that was, you know, creating waves, but, we were a couple, and that was pretty much everything I'd wanted. Jetta was always a lot of fun to be around, and she was challenging intellectually, and it was fun to have discussions with her. And she, you know, would laugh at my jokes and play along with my silly gags. So I was pretty content.
And how did you feel about that, Jetta? Were you guys kind of going steady in your mind?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the time that we first started talking, it was pretty much official. And, you know, I got a lot of flack for it from my family, from church leaders, that kind of stuff. You know, but being a teenager, you always think, well, I'm the exception. So,
Which you are. You guys are still, how long have you guys been married now?
Well, yeah. And, you know, we truly are an exception. You know, we're pretty exceptional.
So. You are exceptional. That's why we're doing the podcast.
So, you know, I never really worried about it too much. You know, there was definitely, it felt like pointed lessons about, you know, about steady dating and, you know, group dating and that kind of stuff. And I just didn't really let it bother me. And I knew out of all the, you know, the girls that I went to church with that there was definitely girls who were doing things that were more inappropriate, quote unquote, than what I was doing. And so I just didn't really worry about it. You know, my parents weren't too happy about it. My dad did pressure me to break up with Adam at one point, which we did for like 2 hours and then we were back together.
Oh, how cute.
It was terrible.
Aww. So, you know, and it just, Adam was my best friend. We just really, for whatever reason, we just really clicked and really hit it off and we just loved spending time together. So
that's great. And so you guys graduated about a year apart. What was your life after high school?
I went to Ricks. Yay. Mm-hmm. And, I got a 2-year degree, associate's degree. I got in fashion design, and I don't regret the time there. I didn't love it as a school, didn't love the cold weather, but I did enjoy my teachers. My program was really tiny. It was like 30 students that we were in classes together all day, and so the environment was really cool. And so that's what I did after school, did that, and then I worked for a year or so waiting to turn 21, just kind of biding my time.
To go on a mission? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, that was still on my mind. It's still my plan.
Got it. Okay. All right. So you were still headed that way. And were you and Adam still dating during this time?
Yeah, we were. And it was kind of, you know, kind of difficult. I'd call him every day. I had a prepaid phone card and we'd call long distance every day and talk. And I'm sure it was harder for him than it was for me because I was in a different environment around new people. So I was busy and doing things and I did feel bad. I felt like I'd kind of left him behind. Hmm.
So Adam, you stayed in the same place.
I did. Yeah. When she graduated and left for Ricks, I still had a year of high school left. I stayed and finished my last year of high school and then I did a summer term at Ricks in a program that I lovingly refer to as Dumb Kids College because my SAT scores weren't good because I just didn't put a lot of
thought into it.
A lot of thought into them the day before. I think I found some number two pencils and made sure I knew where it was. So I went to Dumb Kids College and, you know, did that for, it was a summer term. It was 6 weeks and I decided I was done with Ricks, but was thankful because I had put in my mission papers and had gotten my call by that point. So
go ahead. Sorry.
I worked and waited for the time where my mission would start. I had to wait for some visa papers.
Okay. Okay. So you were working and getting ready to go there while she was at Ricks and then, where did you go on a mission?
I served in the Sao Paulo, Brazil North Mission.
Okay. And what did you speak?
Portuguese.
Okay. That's what I thought.
I remember opening my call and reading and thinking, how in the world am I going to learn Spanish? Which wasn't an issue, thankfully.
Yeah. Yeah. So you learned Portuguese. You went there for 2 years. How was that?
You know, it was great. The church had opened a MTC in Sao Paulo several years prior to me getting my mission call. So I was lucky enough to, you know, go right to Brazil. Okay. It was definitely a shock. I think it was the third largest city in the world at that time.
Oh, wow.
It's like Tokyo, Mexico City, and then Sao Paulo.
Wow.
You know, we're from a town that, you know, I think it's 250,000 people now. Went to a town with 21, 23 million people.
Oh, wow.
My old country boy eyes were opened. But I loved it. immediately kind of fell into the groove of Brazilian society. Very, you know, very comfortable, very friendly people. I loved being in Brazil, and I felt really good about what I was doing. It was hard to leave family and friends, but, I felt the need to pay back the good things that the missionaries who taught me. Mm. So it was a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed it.
Was your dad supportive of this at the time?
You know, he was. It was hard for him. I remember the night before I left, he took me out for Dr. Pepper spins and said, if you need to come home, just call and I will be on a plane, you know, the very next second I can. But he was supportive, you know, being kind of a student of philosophy in the world. He understood that, you know, the hero's journey, there has to be that part where you mm-hmm. step outside the tribe and kind of go, venture out on your own.
Right.
So he respected that.
Right. That's great. And so, you guys kept in contact, and then, what happened after you returned from your mission? Were you still going to Rick's at the time, Jetta?
No, I was long done by then. And okay. I actually, you know, about 6 months after Adam left, I turned in my papers. Mm. And I also served a mission, and it worked out because of our age difference that we were out at the same time and got home within like a month of each other.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, and I served in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, and mm. learned Mandarin Chinese mm. and towered over everybody. And it was a good experience. You know, like I said, I had said before, it's what I always wanted to do, but I'm the kind of person, although I am intellectually smart, I don't always think things through.
Okay.
So I'm the kind of person that kind of jumps in and then I realize what I got into. And then I'm like, oh, what do I do now? And so I didn't really know what being a missionary meant or what it really was going to be. And which was probably a good thing, because I probably would not have done it. And
how so?
Oh, I just probably would have been intimidated and probably would have kind of, you know, talked myself out of it.
Okay.
But it was good, and I had good experiences. I met some really, really great people, and you know, felt, I don't know, like Adam said, I guess, felt really good about what I was doing. Felt like it was important. And at the same time, I, this is going to make me sound really superficial. So I, like, honestly, my biggest, like, hurdle about going on a mission was the dress code. Mm. I was like, and it wasn't that, you know, growing up, it was, you know, very much no tank tops, no short shorts. You know, my parents were very adamant about those things. So it wasn't like I didn't know how to cover myself you know, appropriately, as they say. But it was just the lack of color. And, you know, I had just finished design school. And so I was so interested in shape and color. And I felt like it was really drab and really boring, and I had to, you know, conform to this really specific look. Yeah. And, I look back on it now and I realize that I really gave up a big part of myself at that time in my life to sacrifice and make that decision that has taken me, you know, a good 10 plus years to get back.
As far as like the fashion passion that you had.
Yeah. And just caring about how I look, caring about, and just enjoying that, you know, for a long time, I felt like it wasn't important. It wasn't valuable. And so I didn't spend time on it.
You need to spend more time on spiritual matters rather than temporal, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and even though I did do sewing jobs here and there, they were always like modifying a dress, making it more modest, you know, that kind of stuff.
Not really what you were passionate about.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. Okay, so you guys got back. What year did you guys get back? Because it was just a few, like a month from each other, right?
Yeah, 2003.
Okay.
Okay. In the late 2003, and then we got engaged pretty quickly, and we were married by April of 2004. So we just celebrated our 10th anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
Thanks.
Okay, so you guys got back, you guys got married in 2004, and I assume in the temple, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Which temple?
In the Boise temple.
Boise, okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then what else started happening in your life? You guys start having kids right away, or what happened?
No, you know, and this may be something we can go back to a little bit, but, you know, getting married in the temple meant that we left Adam's family out.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I'm going to get all emotional. So, fall of 2012, they redid the Boise temple, and, we had took that opportunity to take Adam's family through and friends and stuff like that. And we both suddenly, and this was about the time that disaffection started. And so I don't know if we want to edit this out and put it somewhere else, but I feel like it's important. We both kind of started to realize the disservice that we did to his family and to our friends by getting married in the temple. And we both have a lot of regret mm-hmm. About that decision, which didn't really feel like a decision at the time growing up as a member. That's just an expectation, at least mm-hmm. in my family, it was an expectation. It wasn't like, this is a choice you get to make, but that's what you do. Mm-hmm. And I regret now not taking the opportunity to really think about what that meant and the repercussions it would have. And have since apologized to many people about it who have all been very kind. But I do feel like it's such a tragic situation. You know, we talk about how families are eternal and they're so important, and yet we consistently leave them out on some of the most important days of our lives.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Adam, how did your parents feel during that time?
It hurt a lot. I'm sure they were always very, very kind and didn't express that to me, because I think they knew that it was important to me, and also, like Jetta said, just an expectation that that's what it was. And we, you know, we did have a ring exchange ceremony afterwards. Mm-hmm. And my, you know, my bishop presided over that and did his best to make it something that was inclusive for my family. Mm-hmm. But when I looked around the ceiling room, and saw Jetta's family, but didn't see mine, it was painful. It hurt. I didn't regret the decision at that time, because I knew that, you know, I felt that at that time that being sealed in the temple was the most important thing that I could do. Mm-hmm. But I look back at it now with a great deal of regret and a great deal of shame. Mm. And really wish that I had made more inclusive decisions.
Mm. Right. It's hard to think like that when you're in the middle of trying to live the right Mormon life. It's hard to think of it. You're thinking, well, this is just a sacrifice that I need to make.
Yeah, the manipulation and the, you know, the use of the word sacrifice is used so, you know, like it's a pedestal to stand on, and it really is quite tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice that that topic is bringing dialogue in members of the church, and that people are choosing to make a different decision because they're thinking differently. So, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, then what happened after you guys got married?
So we found ourselves a cheap little apartment, and Adam was going to school and working, and I was working, and, you know, we waited a year before we started having kids, and then it just didn't happen. So, you know, I had a miscarriage actually the first month that we were trying, and then, which was really sad because I kind of already told everybody, and it was really, really sad, and nobody really, there wasn't a lot of sympathy.
Really?
It was just like, oh, that's just kind of what happens. That's, you know, and I was like, well, that's never happened to me before. This is really sad.
Yeah.
And
the number of people who say, oh, that happened to us. It's, you know, you'll get over it.
Really?
It was mind blowing.
That is amazing.
Bless their hearts. They're trying to be kind and help us out, but oh, it was so hard to hear.
That's awful. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was hard, and so we just kept trying, and nothing was happening. And we were in the beginning, we weren't too worried about it. You know, you don't think about it. You're healthy young people, and that's what God wants from you, is to have lots of kids. So we just figured it would happen, and you know, we moved on from that apartment. We got a different apartment, and I started working from home because I thought I had this opportunity to work from home, and I thought, oh, it'd be great if we have kids and I can work from home. And then I got really lonely. So we got a dog, and he's amazing. He's our firstborn son. And,
it was one of the best decisions we've ever made.
Yeah. He's big our family. And, so yeah, this is about, I think we've been married for about 4 years about by the time we got Moose, our bulldog. He's super cute. And, we just kept trying and we started, you know, doing the whole gamut, infertility testing, and whose fault is it? And we, you know, felt it was because we didn't have faith or because we were, you know, not doing the right things. And so you buckle down and you think, if I could just be more righteous or more faithful, then I can make this happen. And still nothing was happening, which was really, it was really, really hard. It was a really hard time. And, you know, I come from a very fertile family. And so, it's not something that had ever really come up before, and nobody really knew how to talk about it or how to deal with it. And, sometimes I feel really selfish talking about it, because I think I know there's couples who spent much longer than we did trying to have a family. But I think when you have that kind of a desire on top of the expectation, you know, of family, that it's no matter how long or short it takes, it's hard. It's a really hard thing to go through.
Did you guys have pressure from people who didn't know your situation at church and might have kept a little bit of a judgment about you not having children?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. Just, you know, there's the common, like, oh, when are you guys going to start a family? And, you know, what about kids and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if it was judgment, but there was definitely some really ham-fisted questions that were asked.
Ham-fisted? How do you mean?
Oh, you never know what people are dealing with privately, of course, and people would, you know, ask those questions that would, you know, just end up with their foot in their mouths. You know,
I see.
You guys have been married for a while. No kids yet? Well, yeah, we've been trying, but we can't. You know, that
right.
That always ends the conversation pretty quickly.
Right.
I think you get people who honestly are just jealous because they got pregnant on their honeymoon and they're dealing with three kids and they've been married for 4 years, and they look at us, we've been married the same amount of time and we're kidless, and probably looks like we're just living the life, you know.
You probably do.
Grass is always greener, right?
Yes. Well, you know, after having a child, your time is no longer yours ever.
it finally did happen. Adam was working and going to school, and we decided to move in with his mother, so my mother-in-law, so that we could afford to do some fertility treatments while he was still going to school and trying to make it all work. And it happened that this wasn't the first set of fertility treatments that we had been through. We'd been through a couple others previously, but this time it worked the first time, and so we moved in and got pregnant right away, and it was definitely a very exciting time because we were all very, you know, anticipatory of this thing that we'd waited for so long for. And again, like I said, it was about 5 years that we'd been married when our son was born. So, that may not seem like a long time to some people, but it felt like an eternity.
Yeah. For an LDS family, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was married for 3.5, 4 years. I finished my bachelor's, and then we started trying, and I had received an answer that I knew that I needed to wait until I got my bachelor's to get pregnant. And I had a lot of people preach to me about that, but it's hard because after that, it was like another 3.5 years before I actually got pregnant, had a baby. And it's hard during that time, you know, waiting for that. And that's, so 7 years from the time I got married, that's 5 years is a long time for LDS people to go without having children after they get married.
I remember feeling too that the problem was with me. I remember feeling that if I was more righteous, if I was a better priesthood holder, then God would, you know, entrust a spirit to me. And that, you know, the failings that I had and the weaknesses that I had were preventing us from having kids. And that's a really rough thing to feel for 5 years. You know, I remember looking at Jetta and thinking all she wants is to be a mother, and I can't provide that to her.
Did you guys ever go to your patriarchal blessing for comfort during that time?
I did. Frequently.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, then you get the whole like this life or the next, so it's kind of vague.
I know, that's what I had to do. I'm like, oh, it maybe it's the next life. Yeah.
Well, and I was always frustrated because I have one of those patriarchal blessings that's super, super clear. And it says, you know, children will stand up with honor when the Savior returns to earth. And I remember thinking, you know, the way I interpreted it, which is, you know, the heart of the problem, I guess. I remember thinking, you know, am I Abraham? Am I going to have kids when I'm 90?
Please, this gonna be no. Something that
happens? Yeah, gosh. That's not
good. But it was, you know,
maybe with your third or fourth wife,
sure,
or concubine.
Just had a chill go down my spine. I remember feeling during that period that no matter where I turned, I couldn't find comfort because the narrative of the church is a narrative of families, and those families always include kids. There's always posterity included in that. And when I looked at my family, and I felt we were a family, Jetta and I and our smelly bulldog Moose, that was a family. We were a family. But I remember thinking that it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough.
Well, and I really feel like a lot of time was wasted. You know, when you sit in
so much time wasted.
When you sit in that waiting period, you don't enjoy your life. You don't enjoy the time that you have. And I really look back on it and think we could have done so many more things. We could have had so much more fun if we hadn't been spending so much time worrying and fretting and
and trying to make one thing happen. So you got pregnant, and did you wait for a while before you told everybody because of your miscarriage previously?
Well, I had wanted to, but it wasn't really an option because my mom had convinced me that we were going to have a family fast before this treatment. And so everybody knew that we were going in. Everybody knew. And so, and then everybody knew, you know, it takes, you know, 2 weeks before you know whether or not it worked. And so, and then there was like a family reunion. I had a huge family reunion, like literally like the weekend of or the week after I found out. And so everybody was like, well, you know. And so I just didn't really have an opportunity to say that, you know, to keep it to ourselves for a little while to enjoy that moment. So it was kind of, it was wide news. Yeah. So, and the pregnancy was great. Although being tired for the first, you know, trimester, I love being pregnant. And I knew going into it that it was very likely that it would be the only time I was ever pregnant. And so I worked really, really hard to just enjoy it, every moment of it, to enjoy all of it. And I didn't get sick and have to deal with all of that. So I didn't have to, thankfully, I feel really grateful.
Wow. Yeah.
But I love being pregnant. I felt good. I felt healthy. I felt really strong and just, you know, kind of that, I guess that Viking spirit again, just felt like I could do anything. It was amazing. So, I had a really great pregnancy and you know, Adam was still going to school and I was working from home and we were trying to, you know, continue on with life. And then my son was born, which was, his, you know, again, birthing experience was amazing. I had, you know, people hate me cause I delivered within like 45 minutes of going into full
Are
labor.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know. Every woman hates me. Seriously. I realized I was in labor. We went to the hospital and within 20 minutes of pushing, he was born.
Oh, wow.
And he was beautiful. This beautiful, very long blonde haired little boy that, you know, that we had waited so long for. And he was beautiful. And, it was actually really neat because, you know, I was an on-call doctor because it was such a sudden thing. And the on-call doctor, actually gave me the opportunity to, you know, as soon as his shoulders were out, he said, you want to pull him out. And he guided my hands and put him under his arms. And I pulled him out and pulled him to me. And it was the most just amazing experience that I've probably ever had to this day. You know, that any woman who's given birth knows the high that you experience afterwards and the relief of pain. And, it was just beautiful. And there was, you know, this beautiful moment that Adam and I got to share that, that I would never trade for anything.
Right.
Sorry. Right. I know I sound silly when I cry.
No, you don't.
Anyways, so he was born and he was beautiful and healthy and strong. And then, my sister got married 2 weeks later. this was another, she was supposed to get married that summer. And my son was born in, you know, late winter, and she was supposed to get married in summer. And then like Christmas time, she was like, well, I think I'm going to move the wedding up. And I was like, I think that's a terrible idea because I'd really like to be there and be a part of it and not be dealing with just being a new mom. And so then she decided to move it to like 2 weeks after my due date. And to this day, that's still something that I feel angry about. And the reason that I feel angry about it is because I love my sister. She's great, but she's one of those kind of me people. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much not that kind of person. Mm-hmm. And so my mom wasn't there for me. She was busy with my sister's wedding and getting everything together, and she wasn't there for me. And that was a really, really hard time for me. We're supposed to be mothers as women. We're supposed to be mothers in Zion and supposed to have many children and all this. So my son came and he was the thing I'd waited for. And I don't know if I went into first full, like, postpartum depression. I was never diagnosed with anything like that, but it was a really, really hard time for me. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling like breastfeeding was this creepy, abnormal thing that was weird, and it took me like a month before it stopped hurting and before it started to feel normal. And my son, he had a lot of reflux, and he would eat really fast, and then he'd throw half of it up, and then he'd sleep for 45 minutes, and then he'd want to eat again. Mm-hmm. And it just was this really hard thing for me to deal with. And I remember thinking, I hate being a mom. Mm. And, that again just made me feel guilty and terrible, you know, this thing that I'd waited so long for, and I was terrible at it and I hated it, and he was sucking all the life out of me. And I just felt so guilty about all of it. I felt so terrible. And I know now that many women feel that way that go through that, but I felt really alone.
Right.
Really, really alone.
Right. And you had to take care of it yourself. You didn't have your mom there.
Yeah, I didn't. She was too busy.
Mm. Did Adam's parents come and help at all?
They did. My mom is very sensitive to family issues, and she didn't want to intrude. Mm. We were living with her at the time that our son was born, but she didn't want to. She didn't want to overstep her bounds and take over for Jetta's mom.
But she was sweet. She'd stayed home for a week from work and cooked our meals for a week and kind of
help take care of us and still try to give us our space. And I really was grateful for that.
Right. Yeah, that's hard to deal with. I've heard mothers who, especially when they have tried for a long time to get pregnant, and then they do go through that postpartum depression. And I can't imagine anyone not going through that who can only get an hour of sleep at a time, because I don't think I was ever technically postpartum, but when I didn't have any sleep. And there's no sleep. It's really hard to think normal and to be happy and to be grateful when this thing you've been waiting for, it, like you said, is sucking the life out of you. I absolutely get that.
Yeah.
My daughter cried all the time, and it was frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. It's exhausting. And yeah, I didn't sleep a full night's sleep probably until he was about a year old.
Oh,
10 months to about a year old. Yeah. Cause he was just up 3-4 times a night, and mm-hmm. I just turned into this zombie shell of a person that I, to this day, I still tell Adam, like, thanks for sticking around. I know it was really terrible. This is your life. So after that year of adjustment, how did your family progress? You start taking your son to church. I'm assuming you did the baby blessing and everything. Oh yeah. We were still full TBF at that time.
And when was this that he was born? What year?
It was 2009.
Okay. So you guys were still very, very active in the church. Did you have any callings around this time that the baby was born and you had an infant?
I don't remember. What did we do? Oh, we were primary teachers.
Yeah, which is just
the 3-year-olds, like the sunbeams or whatever.
Mm.
And which is like herding cats. And you know, terrible. I would leave every, you know, 45 minutes to feed Jacob, and Adam was so overwhelmed with these little kids.
Well, and the problem with that was I was always such a rule follower that, you know, I, as a man, for some reason, couldn't be alone in a room with the children.
Mm-hmm.
So every 45 minutes it was, you know, let's walk around and talk about the paintings and all, and somehow incorporate that into this week's lesson.
Oh, that's creative. There
Thanks.
You go.
Desperation.
Well, at that age, you can't keep their attention for very long. So no. Probably worked out perfect. So you had this family, you had the goal that you'd been striving for, and we're here on Mormon Voices. What got you from this, you know, active family to start to navigate towards a faith transition? What brought you to that?
The house that I grew up in was always one where questions were valued.
Mm-hmm.
It was never looked down upon if you had questions. There was no stigma attached to a question.
Mm-hmm.
I look back and I realize that I was probably trying to be, you know, a New Order Mormon for 15 years.
Mm.
You know, because I was always, very liberal in my political views. I always took some real grievance with some harsher, what I saw as unchristlike narratives in the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jetta would go crazy sitting next to me in Sunday school when, you know, someone would bring up the evils of socialism, and I would immediately go find all the scriptures in the Book of Mormon that talk about, you know, community property and the Nephites never being more righteous than when they had all things amongst themselves.
Hmm.
So my frustrations initially began there. The you know, conservative political rhetoric that was passed off as doctrine or, you know, official church stance really bothered me. And I think for me, the spark that really started the fire was when we took my family through the temple open house. I was in the Elders Quorum presidency at that time and dealt a lot with some people in the ward that needed financial assistance and, you know, unemployed, looking for jobs, not being able to find them, that kind of things. And I remember going through the temple with my mom and just being blown away at how opulent everything was in there.
Oh, you mean like how glamorous and expensive and everything?
Yeah. You know, polished marble on the floors and mahogany, everything. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, how many people would this feed? How many, you know, the temple was fine. It worked fine before. Why did we need to make it all fancy and all snazzy?
So they added this.
Yeah. There was a rededication of the Boise temple, a couple of years ago. I don't remember when.
So they added a lot of things to it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it broke my heart. It broke my heart. It was just too ostentatious. It was too flamboyant and too fancy. And, we took my dad through, after we took my mom through, and then I had invited some of my non-member friends through. And each time we went through, I just felt more and more disgusted, by how extravagant it was. And that really was for me the thing that started it. You know, and I remember around that time, kind of allowing myself to go through some of those thought experiments and ask some of those questions. You know, what if the church isn't true? What if, you know, the church there's been a modern day apostasy and the modern day LDS church isn't the church that it was when Joseph Smith founded it. And that's kind of the start of the path that I went down.
Okay.
And, you know, piggybacked on that was the election of 2012, which was not pretty, you know, because every Mormon who was truly a Mormon was, you know, sure that this was our time. And I just remember thinking this is
the White Horse prophecy.
Yeah. Oh, that got passed out at Sunday school.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, no. We live in a very interesting ward. Anyway, so that, you know, and that got to me. I was never, like, super concerned about, you know, people's personal views, but when it became so prevalent and so pushed in Sunday school, I was just like, this is ridiculous. And someone put it well, it's this assumption of shared belief that I didn't share. And I didn't feel like I was a part of whatever they felt they were a part of. But for me, I don't remember how Adam must have been listening to some of the podcasts in Mormon stories or something.
I had started listening to podcasts as a way to supplement what I felt was a kind of a lackluster spiritual education. I didn't feel like I was being, I didn't feel like I was getting enough in the correlated material that I heard on Sunday. So I started, originally listening to, the Mormon Stories podcast, and kind of use that as just some extracurricular learning.
Yeah. So Adam, you know, turned me on to the Mormon Stories podcast. And I remember the first one I picked to listen to was one about Eldon Karchner, and he's a gay man who tried to live the church. And, if you haven't listened to the story, I thought it was really fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Anyway, and I have a brother who is gay and, who came out when he was like 18, I was like 16, and it was kind of this big hoopla in my family. And, you know, it was kind of a difficult thing, and he and I were always really close. And then that happened. And I'm sure I said some things that were offensive, and I you know, just had difficulty trying to understand and comprehend it. And then I listened to this interview, and I felt like everything kind of started falling down. And it was the first time in my life that I had questioned, what is the spirit? What does that mean? What does that feeling even mean? And I stopped thinking about it because it was too much. Mm. So I just like constantly listened to like Radiolab podcasts and tried not to think about it for like 2 or 3 months. And then finally I was like, okay, I have to deal with this. Because I realized, you know, in the back of my mind, even though I wasn't consciously processing, in the back of my mind, I was realizing that either God exists and he's a terrible prick, or he doesn't, and all this is just made up. Mm. And I just came to the point where I was like, you know what, if this is really what God wants, if God really wants people who he supposedly made that way or were born this way, or even if circumstances under outside of their control made them that way, made them, you know, attracted to the same gender, and then they were expected to never experience love, never experience sexual pleasure, never experience love like I have with my husband. And if that's really what God wants for these people, I can't be with God. I mm-hmm. can't. I would rather go to hell than go to heaven with a God like that. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized I just couldn't do it anymore. And I literally went from being a completely total true believer to I can't have anything to do with the church within 6 months. Mm. And it was difficult. Like I said, I tried to put off thinking about it for a few months. I tried to put off making the decision, and then I couldn't live with the disparity anymore. I couldn't live with, you know, being told one thing on Sunday and feeling something totally and completely different.
Right. Right. It's almost like you have your sensibilities are,
returned to you.
Yeah. And that your sensibility is almost like as a human being with your own thoughts and your own feelings about things are almost, what's the word? Offended, you know, by going and having to listen to things that divide you from the things that you feel, are truths and that bring you peace.
There's a struggle there because you intend and desire to be an independent actor, mm-hmm. and independent actors don't fit in well in the LDS church.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was always the kind of person that, like, you know, people would talk about abortion, or they would talk about, you know, same-sex marriage, or they would talk about these things, and I would kind of shut down. I would try really hard not to express how I felt about it one way or the other. And I think it's because I knew that I felt differently than I was supposed to feel about it. And I, you know, being such a pleaser, I just felt, well, I just won't think about it. I'll just do what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I won't think about it. Then I don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But I really just put off coming to my own logical conclusions about how I felt about it because I knew that I didn't, you know, hold the correlated views that I was supposed to have.
I think a lot more people feel that way than we think.
For sure.
Because you see a lot of people just sitting there, and it would be interesting to really know what they're really feeling about it. Yeah. So and you like would, I, oh, I'm sorry, go
I was,
ahead.
I would say, like I said, I just felt like if I really explored it, that I was afraid of the conclusion I would come to.
Right.
And so I just never expressed any views because I obviously didn't hold the views I was supposed to have. And so I just said, oh, I don't know. I don't know. And kind of played dumb about it.
You probably had to get emotionally prepared to accept what you knew, but didn't want to know at the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, and I was the opposite. I was always a firebrand, and I was the, you know, the person who would have arguments in elders quorum about the Equal Rights Amendment. And
oh, wow.
Well, and I remember the last elders quorum that I was in was a very safe place and a very comfortable place. The elders quorum president worked really hard to make sure that it was a place of exploration and a place of community. And I remember, one time feeling like I'd overstayed my welcome when the teacher was giving a lesson on the gifts of the Spirit. Mm. And I raised my hand and said, guys, I'm not sure that I've ever felt the constant companionship of the Holy Ghost. What's that feel like? Hmm. And, you know, all of a sudden everybody was looking at their tablets or playing with their scriptures or something else. And I remember, feeling very, very alone.
Really?
That I'd struck too close to the bone, and that it just was, like I said, I'd overstayed my welcome.
Mm. Well, the great secret is that nobody knows, right? Nobody knows the answer to that.
Yeah.
That's probably why they were looking in their scriptures. I mean, I think we're kind of trained to find the answers in writing rather than really feeling that answer and speaking what comes to our hearts.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because if we pay attention to our hearts, they often are not correlated with
right.
what we're supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah, the heart doesn't correlate easily.
Right. There's a, have to like almost disconnect to follow everything. Yeah. Wow. So you were already, pretty much transitioned, Adam, and then Jetta just kind of caught up, or is that kind of how it happened?
I'd say it was actually the other way around. Mm. Jetta had after she listened to that series of interviews with Eldon Garchner. And for those of you who haven't listened, it focuses all about some really powerful spiritual experiences that he had where he felt the spirit was directing him in one way and the opposite happened. Mm. And I remember wondering if the LDS church had undergone an apostasy and I just needed to find the right church to belong to again, or, if I could do something to change it from the inside out. Mm. But I remember for me, the real breaking point for me is our son had aged out of primary. He was, now going into, aged out of nursery. He was now going into primary, and he was very uncomfortable. He didn't, nursery and primary are very different worlds. There's no toys in primary. There's no snacks in primary. And he was uncomfortable. He was very shy. And I remember he would cry and he didn't want to go in there. And one day, I hate thinking about this, but one day I remember, just thinking, the best thing for me to do as his father and his, his patriarch, I need to just force him into going to primary. This is the path that he needs to be on. And I was very gentle and very kind to him and told him, Bard, you have to go to class. So we're going. And I remember I walked into the primary room. They were just starting their opening exercises. And now that I say that, that's the craziest thing to do for a bunch of 4-year-olds. Why do 4-year-olds need opening exercises? I'm sorry. That's a tangent. So I plopped him down in the chair and he was just wailing. He was scared. He was frightened. He was not happy. And I remember I told him, I said, stop crying. Don't do that. Mm. And bless his heart, he stopped and the tears still rolled down his face. And he drew in those little ragged, shallow breaths. And he sat there and I was in the back of the room. I told him that I'd stay in the room. But I remember looking at him and it just crystallized. I remember thinking, if I wanted to, I could break his spirit. Ugh. This is the tipping point. And I wasn't willing to do that. Hmm. I wasn't willing to destroy in him what I loved the most. And I remember after opening exercises finished and they were sending the kids off to the class, I went and grabbed him. And he and I just went and sat in the foyer and I held him. And I realized that he's a lot like me and there wasn't a place for folks like he and I in the LDS church.
Hmm. How did he respond to your change in activity when you guys decided to not go to church? Was it kind of sudden or did it happen gradually, and how did he respond to it?
Every once in a while, I still ask him just because, I I had a parent who trusted me enough to let me explore my faith and my spirituality. And I want to be the same thing for him. But every once in a while, I'll still ask him, you know, Pard, do you want to go to church this Sunday? What do you think? You know, do you miss going to church? And he always says, no, it was kind of boring. So I think he's just fine with the nature hikes and early Sunday matinees that we do now.
Did you guys ask to be released from your callings? How did that transition from being active to not active? How did that happen for you guys?
So I was in the Young Women's Presidency, and I had asked to be released. I said, I can't do this right now. I need a break from a calling. I need some breathing room to kind of figure out what I'm feeling. And this is before I had made my ultimate decision. And
Did you know that you were making a decision? Is that why?
I just felt like I felt like I couldn't separate what I really felt and what I was. I couldn't separate myself from what I was being told.
Okay.
And I needed some space to allow my own thoughts to breathe and to stop being told what I'm supposed to believe. I just needed some space to figure things out. And I was teaching monthly, at least sometimes semi-monthly, these young women. And I just felt, you know, I can't teach this. I don't know what I believe. I don't know what I feel. And, yeah, they took about a month replacing me, and I was kind of like, I need this. And so I asked to be released, and let's see what happened. So shortly after I actually officially got released, though I hadn't really been doing much of my calling at that time, it was probably about a month, our bishop called us in and was like, so how are you feeling? Do you want, you know, can I give you another calling? And I was like, no, I don't want a calling right now. I don't want any. And he's, we kind of left this part out. So about when our son was three, we had decided that we would try adoption because we weren't able to have any more kids. Nothing was happening. And so we got, you know, all signed up with LDS Family Services, and anybody who's ever tried to go through all the adoption loopholes, it's so time consuming. Yeah.
Emotionally exhausting too, because you answer these questionnaires that just drag you through the depths of your, you know, your terrible personhood. It was so rough.
Wow.
And then you attend these classes with other want to be adoptive parents, and it's I hate to use this word. It felt very cult-like. It was just like, it was a single mindset of this was the most important thing in everybody's life. And we would go, and we were like, this is so strange. This is so weird. You know, these LDS family service meetings at the church, all about adoption. And I just felt, this is weird.
Who's ever attended an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, that's what it was like, except really? Without the coffee.
Yeah, like a support group. So we did that for a year, and we're coming up on the point where we were left to think about whether or not we wanted to renew our home study and this and that. And we were just kind of hemming and hawing about it, and we were still trying to decide what we wanted to do about church. And so we have this meeting with our bishop, and I told him I didn't want any callings. And he said, well, I don't think I can recommend you for adoption. And I said, what? And he said, well, you know, there's the expectation that you'll be, you know, in a strong LDS family and blah, blah, blah. And I was so offended.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's why I left, because I was totally offended. So I just was hurt, because this was a man that had known Adam since he was baptized. You know, we lived in the same area we grew up in. And I was just kind of hurt because I felt like he was judging us. You know, I hadn't come to that decision. I wasn't there yet. I just needed some space, and I felt like he was really judging us. And I was really hurt by it, and came home from that. And I was just like, you know what? I don't think I want to do this anymore. I don't know why we keep putting ourselves through this. And I just stopped going to church. We woke up one Sunday and I was like, I'm not going to go today. And then we woke up the next Sunday and I was like, I'm not going to go today. And then I just stopped. I was like, that's it. I'm done.
So did you guys have any outreach kind of like from your ward trying to get you back?
Are you expecting me to talk now?
I think we had, we had some, it was more familial outreach. One of the, I think she was the Relief Society president at that time, was in on a ward council meeting where the beans were spilled that we'd left. And she knew Jetta's parents and went to Jetta's parents and said, "What's wrong?" And we hadn't told them yet. So they said, "Nothing. What do you mean?" And she, you know, she explained that we, you know, we had been to church in, you know, 3 or 4 weeks and, you know, we'd left the church. We, you know, asked to be released from our callings. And it was not an ideal situation. It was really unpleasant, to lose control, I guess, of the way that that was told to Jetta's parents.
Yeah, there's not a lot of boundaries in the church when it comes to
sure
people's
isn't.
Lives.
Yeah, and I remember. So we were out, and Jetta's parents knew, but we didn't know that they knew. We kind of suspected. Jetta's dad was in the stake high council at the time, so we kind of figured it had filtered up to him at some point. I remember Jetta's mom was out of town visiting some family, and we had invited him over for a barbecue.
He invited himself over.
For yeah, that's right.
So that was fine.
We were having a barbecue and he came over, which was fine, right? There's always another hot dog. But, you know, we had dinner and put our son to sleep, and he didn't make the normal, "Well, I'm going to head home," rumblings that most people make at the end of the dinner. And he stuck around, and we kind of realized that we were about to get talked to. And you know, he is a man who has lived his whole life in the church, and found a lot of joy and personal satisfaction in it. So I think it's something that he feels very passionately about and feels like he needs to defend. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard listening to him talk specifically about his son, Jetta's brother, who's gay. He was a loving father in every sense. He wasn't hateful. He didn't use, you know, hateful words or anything like that. But it was very clear to me that he saw his son as sinning.
Really?
Yeah. And it was hard, because what do you say to someone who just lays their, you know, their heart and soul bare in front of you? Saying, "Well, I don't feel that way," doesn't cut it. It doesn't feel right.
Right. So he was he trying to kind of warn you guys against leaving? Is that, was that his mission?
I think he was just trying to understand where we were at. Because like I said, I had voiced a couple of concerns about church doctrines, but I hadn't really expressed any real concerns with my parents. And, to realize that the beans had totally been spilled and people were asking them if we're okay and they have no idea what's going on, I felt terrible. And I also felt completely emotionally unprepared to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he did the whole, "Well, you shouldn't, you know," I tried reading, you know, church history on, you know, some stuff online, and it just gave me bad feelings. So I stopped reading, and he didn't even know that wasn't even, I mean, yeah, some of the church history stuff adds to my justification, but it was not the problem that I had with the church initially. And so it just felt, you know, he was just trying to, you know, give fatherly advice and try to encourage us to, you know, kind of stick it in there. And
yeah, there's a definite feeling of needing to save people. And I felt that so strongly when I would have family members leave. I felt this overwhelming sense of anxiety that if I didn't say something or fast for them or something, then, you know, I'm partly responsible for at least trying, you know, even if it was just prayer. Yeah.
Well, and how could you not feel that anxiety? The message from the church is these people are now going to be separated from you forever.
Forever. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, and I remember coming to, a knowing, around 2009. I just remember sitting there in church and I just had this overwhelming knowing that everyone has their own journey and it's okay. And it was this wonderful, peaceful feeling of, oh, everyone's going to get it eventually. There's no need to worry. It's all equally honored. Sorry, that was,
no, that's,
I went off on my tangent.
That's a powerful realization to come to, because all of a sudden you're living in an inclusive world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not something that the LDS Church does very well.
Right. Right. And I kind of figured it's kind of a Zion mentality that we all see eye to eye, that I can look at a gay man. I can look at, somebody who believes in communism, even, you know, just look at them and honor them as my brother and my sister, and that we are equally, valuable, and just listen to each other's truths.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I realized as I was working through some of these things that, you know, almost a year and a half ago now, that I just felt such a disparity between church culture and church doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like, you know, the core teachings of the church were so beautiful and so, loving and all these things. And then you get into the culture and it felt so the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to realize how much the church culture is turning into church doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that are said over the pulpit are so backhandedly loving.
Yes.
They're so, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so disrespectful, mm-hmm, in so many ways that it just kind of clicked for me. It just kind of came into clear view. And that's, you know, when it was all over for me.
So how did you guys redefine your goals and your relationships? I mean, now you've always had this goal of this forever family, and now you have a different paradigm, which is great that you both were kind of on the same page around the same time. But how did you start redefining your family, your goals, yourselves, your marriage?
I was never comfortable being the patriarch in the family. Mm. Jetta's way too smart and way too capable to have to play second fiddle to me. So I always, and that's not what I wanted. I always wanted a partner. I never wanted someone to be subservient to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we were very, very fortunate and very lucky that we didn't have to, have those kinds of conversations. I never saw Jetta as inferior or secondary to me or to manhood, to priesthood, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was tricky because I was the one that, went to school and was pursuing a career, while Jetta was never against that and was always very supportive. You know, we might have made different decisions,
mm-hmm,
if we had had, different outlooks and different goals when we started those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we're still talking about today. We're not 100% sure where that's going to be in the next year, next 2 years.
Right.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a work in progress. I have to say, it sounds weird now saying this because I don't really know what I believe about God, but I say, thank God I didn't have any more kids, because I love my son. He is the light of my life. He's my little ball of sunshine, but I don't want any more kids, and I don't want to be a stay-at-home mom forever. I don't want it. It's not for me. And I feel so freeing to be able to say, that's not me, and not feel guilty about it.
Well, that's interesting. That's good. That's really good.
Yeah, it feels really healthy, and it feels really good. And I feel bad for those women who are trying to keep themselves in that little role. As some women love it, I shouldn't say it's a little role. It's a big role.
Yeah.
And some women love it and thrive on it. And I say, more power to you. That's fantastic. And some women hate it. And I say, that's great. Do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I feel really free to be able to say, you know what? I have, you know, another year or so of being at home and doing the stay at home mom thing. And then I don't know, my life feels really wide open and it feels really exciting. Like, there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of choice. And I just have to figure out what I want to do. And I feel like for the first time in my life, I get to make my own decisions. I get to make my own choice about what I'm going to be when I grow up.
Right. It's almost like a, do you feel more excitement, or do you also feel scared at that as well?
Oh, I'm terrified. Absolutely. It's totally terrifying because, you know, growing up in the church, you have, you know, it's all laid out for you. Mm-hmm. There's no questions about it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it is terrifying because there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of what ifs. There's a lot of what if I make a mistake? What if I do it wrong? What if I make the wrong choice?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if I go back to school and then I start working and I hate it? And, you know, it's all sorts of questions. But at the same time, I'm so excited by it. I feel so free. I just feel alive again. I feel like I can be me and I don't have to hide who I am. I don't have to be ashamed of who I am.
Mm.
And that feels so amazing. Mm. It feels so amazing.
That's wonderful. What about you, Adam? Have you noticed a difference with how you look at yourself?
Definitely. I kind of spoke to it earlier when we were talking about our struggles with infertility, but I never felt good enough. I always felt like I was never righteous enough. I you know, never fulfilled my callings enough, didn't read my scriptures enough. I never felt good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt like I lived up to the standard that was laid by the church. And it was very nice to lay that aside and look at myself and know that I was enough,
mm-hmm.
That I didn't have to live up to anyone else's arbitrary goals and measures, and that I could just work on being a better me and allow myself to make mistakes and allow myself to goof up and allow myself to not know what comes next. I'm still working on that one. I'm not super great at it yet. But
no, you're not. But I feel, I think it's great. No, I think it's great because, like Adam mentioned before, our son is so much like him and he's so afraid to make mistakes. He's so afraid to try things if he doesn't think he'll succeed. And I think it's such a great opportunity to, you know, as parents to show him like, yeah, I failed. And I'm going to pick up and I'm going to try again.
Mm.
And it feels, you know, it feels so good to be okay with making mistakes. And it's not the end of the world. I don't have to go see the bishop. I don't have to, you know, have godly sorrow and pray on my knees because I did something wrong or I made a mistake.
Right. Right. That's,
I think, one of the things that I enjoy the most is doing the right thing because that's what I feel it is.
Mm.
And not living a life based on reward or punishment, you know, an afterlife in the case of the church. It feels good to, it feels good to be my own person.
Mm. All right. What about your relationships with your family members? Adam, you first, and then Jetta, your immediate family that you grew up with, your parents, how has that been affected?
It's great. My parents were always supportive while I was a member of the LDS Church. My mom was very concerned that, you know, something was wrong, that, you know, we'd been hurt or wronged by someone. And I remember I took her out to, I think we went and had a cup of coffee at the Barnes and Noble's cafe. And I just kind of told her, you know, what we've been talking about here tonight, and explained where we were, and like, she supported me going in, she supported me coming out. Just wanted the best for me and to make sure I was okay. My dad was, he was excited. I won't even describe it as anything else. I think he felt like he got his son back. And I, and he got
the drinking buddy he always wanted to have, right?
He sure did. He sure did. He never pressured me, but
he had a lot to teach you.
I know. I'm so behind. But I feel so grateful that he made the choice that he did. But I think he feels, and he should, I think he feels like the decision he made 15 years ago to allow me to follow my heart was finally justified.
Mm.
In that I didn't change. I'm still who I was. My heart is still the heart that it was 15 years ago. That feels good. That feels good. It's good too. My sister and I are still brother and sister. So we still deal with, with sibling issues, but it's good to not feel a gulf between us. I grew up with five or six guys that were never members of the church, but were brothers to me. And it's so wonderful to be able to interact with them like I did before I joined the church. Mm. So cool to come back around and see those people there still supporting me and still, caring for me.
Yeah. Have they expressed that they feel a little bit more open, like they can talk more about things with you?
Yeah, they were supportive too. They might not have agreed with the decisions that I made, but I think that they, liked me and wanted the best for me. So they were, they were kind and respectful throughout. It is good to sit down and have conversations, kind of not have to feel like I have to defend the church or sugarcoat things to make the church look better. And it's fun to be who I am, open and honest, and not have to pretend.
Yeah. What about you, Jetta? It's probably a lot different from Adam's experience.
Yeah, it definitely is. So I have a brother who is not active, obviously, and then I have a sister who the week my dad confronted me decided that she was getting a divorce and she hasn't been going to church either. And so it was kind of this double whammy. Mm-hmm. And then my aunt died that summer. And so it was emotionally a very difficult time last year. And I think we're kind of coming to a new normal. I emailed my, cause when my dad first talked to us last year and I told him, I was like, I just need some time. I need some space. I need some thinking to do. And so I emailed him a few months ago and my parents both, and just kind of told him, I know you don't agree with my decision and that's okay. I want you to know they still respect you as parents and what you taught me. And I still value our relationship and hope that we can still, have good times together. And so while things are kind of strained, my mom is very afraid of offending anybody. So she tries not to do anything that she thinks will be offensive and then just kind of winds up not doing anything. My dad, I can tell, wants to talk about it, but doesn't bring it up. And I'm okay either way. I'm really at the point where I'm like, if they want to talk about it, we can talk about it. If they don't, whatever. But I feel really good about where I'm at. And so this time last year, I was constantly in panic attacks and anxiety about interacting with my family and what I was going to say, what I was going to wear. My mom was doing garment underwear checks on me and just the whole thing. Yeah. And so I'm finally in a place where I feel good about where I'm at. I really, I still have a lot of decisions to make. I still have a lot of things I'm figuring out, but I feel good about where I'm at. And so I feel more confident in talking about it. But it hasn't really come up. It's kind of the elephant in the room, which everybody sees and feels, but I don't really care about. So,
right.
Whatever. But I do still have issues with, my family is very, when I have siblings come into town, it's, we want to do everything together all weekend. And, there's that, you don't have to come to everything. We don't expect you to, but they kind of do. And so I have a really hard time setting boundaries for myself and expectations and being able to say no without feeling guilty. And, And then thinking, well, what if they think it has to do with the fact that I don't go to church anymore? And they think I don't want to spend time with them because I don't go to church anymore. And so I'm still dealing with some of those kind of issues. But overall, I think, I know I'm okay. So I'm like, I'm sure it'll come up. I'm sure there'll still be some confrontations. I'm sure because I have a 15-year-old niece who I'm sure my brother won't be very happy about me wearing tank tops around and that kind of stuff. But it'll get worked out. We'll figure it out. So,
right. It sounds like you guys have, it hasn't been that long ago since you've gone through it. Sounds like about 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we've officially stopped attending church about a little over a year ago.
Okay.
It's been about 18 months since we really first started the journey, if you want to call it that.
Right. Right. And, hold on. There was a question I had with that. Okay. So what prompted you to, and this is kind of my own question, you don't have to answer this, but what prompted you to want to do Mormon Voices, to share this story?
Hopefully it's not totally boring for,
it's
for
not.
Everybody. For me, when I was so torn, I found other people's stories really comforting. So I listened to every episode of Mormon Voices because I just found the stories really comforting. I found people's stories about finding themselves, about going through what I was going through. I found it really comforting, and I found the idea that, oh, I can make it through this. There's another side. And so I guess for me, it's part of it for myself. It feels a little healing. It feels like a process for me. And I hope, you know, in a non-selfish way, I hope that maybe someone else might find comfort and might be able to relate to my story or how I feel or what I've been through.
Mm. I'd echo what Jetta said, that, you know, hearing other people's stories, getting familiar with the emotions and the challenges that people feel when they transition out of the LDS church was really helpful. I mentioned that I listened to the Mormon Stories podcast, and I'm fortunate enough to have a job where I can listen to podcasts pretty much all day. Mm. And, I remember always being afraid of the Mormon Expression podcast because I'd heard it was a little more anti-Mormon, but it's funny. I remember one day I finally took the plunge and downloaded a few episodes. It was the Mormons and Masons episode. I was really interested in those. And found the discussion to be, you know, an incredibly high caliber discussion and thought provoking and interesting. And it really, really helped me logically think through some knots that I'd tied in my brain. So I think that the Mormon Expression podcast network and the Whitefields Educational Foundation really holds a place of high regard in my view.
Hmm. It's, you know, it's interesting. I noticed that in asking that question, you guys had the same response as about going on missions, kind of like your way of giving back. And, isn't that kind of something in our culture, in Mormon culture? It doesn't, when I started, finding out information that the church had kept hidden from me all my life, I was so happy to find all these podcasts, and then it didn't surprise me because we have a culture in Mormonism where we're used to getting up and bearing our testimonies. You know, we're encouraged.
Absolutely.
Yeah. To get up and tell our story. And that's, very culturally expected, encouraged. And I think it is healing, Jetta. I think there is something healing about sharing, a testimony in the sense of what you have found in your life to be true and to work for you.
I think too, we hear stories, you know, the Good Samaritan, we are encouraged as Mormons to seek out those who need help.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the
unless
trick
is, they're ex-Mormon. Sorry.
I think the trick is that it's not a Mormon value, it's a human value.
Mm, right.
And when we see others in pain, we go to help them.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And I would agree with you, Cammie. I think that some of the nicest people, I mean that non-sarcastically, some of the best people I know are Mormons. And there's some, like my father is one of the most service-oriented, you know, he doesn't say he loves you, but he'll show you he loves you kind of people. And he would do anything for anyone. And even strangers. He's the most honest person I know. My dad is the most honest person I know. And I still really, really value those things about him and what he taught me. And I don't see those as being something the church gave him or taught him. It's just who he is. Mm-hmm. And
those aren't Mormon things. Those are good people things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think, you know, as people, I think we do ourselves a big disservice when we think that it's because of the culture, it's because of this or that. I mean, I think the Mormon culture definitely draws a certain kind of person in, mm-hmm. A certain different kinds of people, but a certain attributes of people. And, but I don't think that's because, you know, because they're more righteous or they're golden or whatever. It's just, you know, we as people are drawn to other people like us.
I really appreciate you sharing your stories. Is there anything you'd like to say just in conclusion?
Sweetheart, do you want to say anything?
I don't know if there's anything more to say I haven't said. I mean, I guess if it was anything, it'd be, you know, a message of hope that, that we're all people of worth. We all have value, and that value comes from inside of us, from who we are, from the things we have to add to the world and to those around us. And that although the journey can be difficult, and then there's a lot of hurdles and hardships, that coming through the other side has been so rewarding and so full of hope and so full of joy and excitement that I've never experienced in my life before, and that I wish everybody could have, you know, as a missionary, I could share this message with everybody. And, you know, I don't know if there is a God or if there's not a God or if there's gods, or I don't know, but I do know that we as people are amazing and resilient, and we have so much to give to each other. And if we choose to give of ourselves and to love and love each other, that our lives will be so enriched and so fulfilling. Mm. So
thank you.
I wrote a letter to my dad when I was on my mission, and it was at a really low point in my mission. I was scared and confused, and I wrote him a letter. I was afraid that he really was going to come down to Brazil and get me. So I didn't go that far. I just said, you know, kind of a woe is me, throwing my hands up in the air. I don't know what to do. And about 2 weeks later, I got his response. And I was kind of ready for him to, you know, I was kind of ready for a plane ticket to fall out of the envelope. But he shared with me a piece of advice that my grandfather had shared with him when he was younger. And he said, "Pard, don't push the river." Mm. And he didn't offer any explanation. He just kind of left it for me to think about it. So here's my interpretation. You can go stand in the middle of a river, and if you're facing upstream, you can push that river as hard as you want, but the water is still going to flow downstream. And if you turn around and you are facing downstream, you can push that water as hard as you want, and it is still going to go downstream at the pace it was earlier. So there is no need to force anything. Be that your membership in the church, your relationships with other people, you need to let the river flow as it will and trust that in the end it leads into the ocean, which is wide and vast and has lots of possibilities.
Hmm. Beautiful.